case on calendar is case number 59638, Branch Banking and Trust Company versus Lindhaven and Tollway. Before we get underway, our counsel for the respondents dividing time.
We are, Your Honor. We will be taking, I think, 10 minutes of the time. Ms. Valenzo will be taking 5 minutes.
Okay. Counsel for the appellant may proceed, and if you want, reserve time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Frank LaForge, and I represent BB&T, the appellant. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. The central issue in this appeal is whether the legislature intended subsection 1 of NRS 4455 to prohibit a creditor from recovering a deficiency based on an out-of-state trustee sale conducted pursuant to the forum state's trustee sale procedure and not Nevada's.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? I don't want to interrupt. I didn't get your presentation. I'll tell you, here's my concern. 4.455 subsection 1 refers to foreclosures conducted under NRS 107080, which is Nevada foreclosures. Tell me why it's applicable to out-of-state foreclosures when it specifically references that statute.
Well, I think you have to look very closely at the language and the context in which it falls. And in this instance, our position is that that language must be illustrative. In fact, when the legislature created 4455 in 1969, subsection 1, contained the first reference to the term trustee sale, whereas judicial foreclosure was already expressly delineated earlier in Chapter 40, in 4430. Moreover, I think there are three reasons why the text must be construed in this manner. First, respondent's entire argument is based on the supposition that that pursuant to clause must serve a restrictive function. But it's indisputable, as we demonstrated in our briefs, that the legislature often uses that same language to serve an illustrative function. And in fact, we gave two examples from the deficiency statutes themselves, 4463 and 4464. I'll discuss briefly 4463, which protects homeowners from foreclosure consultants. In each of its definitions, the definition is explicitly tied to a foreclosure conducted pursuant to NRS 4451 through 4463. The problem is, none of those statutes actually authorize foreclosure sale. They merely refer to the deficiency scheme generally. Instead, foreclosures are conducted under 4430 for judicial foreclosure or 1700 for trustee sales. Therefore, to give any meaning to the pursuant to language in 4463, one must construe it that pursuant to language to serve an illustrative function. 4464 is the same way. We think subsection 1 must be construed in a similar manner. Second,
do you think 40.455 subsection is ambiguous in any way?
I'm sorry, which provision?
40.455 subsection 1. Is it ambiguous?
I think it's unclear. If you look at where that clause fits, it fits into a greater clause that sets forth the statute of limitations. And therefore, even if you were to take an exclusionary reading of that clause, would simply take out-of-state trustee sales out of the six-month statute of limitation. Moreover, where the legislature has set forth every other limitation on a creditor's right to recover deficiency, and has consistently done so in a separate single section or subsection. And in fact, 4455 sets forth its substantive restrictions in subsection 3, which, as it's currently drafted, pertains to purchasing of home mortgages. Therefore, it makes sense that if the legislature intended to impose this substantive restriction, it would have done so in a separate section or subsection. And I also know that subsection 1 has always been construed by this court in its 44 years in existence as a statute of limitations. Third, I think this Court's holdings in KeyBank and Alaska v. Donalds are controlling in this case. This Court had two key holdings. First, it held that deficiency statutes are to be narrowly construed in favor of creditors because they derogate from the common law. Second, the Court using that standard looked very closely at Alaska's anti-deficiency statute. And just to take a step back, the issue in that case was whether Alaska's anti-deficiency statute prohibited a creditor on an Alaskan debt from recovering a deficiency after a foreclosure or trustee sale in Nevada using Nevada's trustee sale procedure. Using the narrow standard of construction, it looked very closely at Alaska's statute, which prohibited deficiencies based on trustee sales, comma, as authorized by AS 34-20070, comma. This Court looked at those two offsetting commas, and John McGay indicated a clear intent that the legislature intended that clause to serve a restrictive function within the subset, within the section. In other words, Alaska's anti-deficiency statute only prohibited deficiencies where the trustee sale was held in Alaska. In contrast, the legislature in this case chose not to offset the clause referencing 07-10700 with offsetting commas. There stands to reason that the legislature in this case did not intend that clause to serve an exclusionary function. Looking a little bit beyond the text, the clearest legislative pronouncement on this issue of out-of-state foreclosure is actually found in subsection 6C of NRS 4430, the one action rule. That provision provides that a creditor may recover a deficiency after an out-of-state foreclosure only if the out-of-state foreclosure did not result in a personal judgment against the debtor. But the thing about judicial foreclosure as opposed to trustee sales is that it combines both the foreclosure process with the deficiency process in such a way that it generally results in a single action in which there is a personal judgment against the debtor. Therefore, in this exception to the one action rule, the legislature seems to be contemplating that a creditor like BB&T may recover a deficiency based on the out-of-state trustee sale.
But you don't disagree with the fact that the Texas non-judicial foreclosure sale didn't comply with NRS 10708-0. Is that contested?
It's not contested, but I think it's not the right question because I don't think the legislature intended I don't think the legislature intended 10700 to apply out of state, where somehow in a patchwork manner, sometimes it can overlap with the form state's trustee sale procedure and sometimes it can't. In fact, if you look at 10700, it, for example, requires the county recorder to transmit money to Nevada's state fund, Nevada's foreclosure mediation program. I doubt the legislature would be so bold as to commandeer the funds of another state's county recorder.
So by its terms, you're saying 10708-0 is a localized statute without extra Nevada reach?
Absolutely. Last, I'd like to note that there's no support whatsoever in the legislative history of 4455 for response reading. Given that their position asks this court to construe subsection 1 in a manner that would make Nevada the only state in the union to specifically discriminate against out-of-state trustee sales, one would expect some discussion of concerns with out-of-state trustee sale procedure. There is none. Instead, in 1969, when the legislature met to decide Nevada's seminal deficiency scheme, their concerns were with the problems associated with judicial foreclosure where it is the only way of recovering a deficiency, as in California. And in fact, the legislature opted not to follow California and adopted a broader deficiency scheme. It therefore seems extremely unlikely that the legislature would have nevertheless chosen to adopt judicial foreclosure as the sole mechanism by which one may obtain a deficiency based solely because the property is located outside the state. One last point. As a matter of public policy, and if you look at the policy behind deficiency statutes, there is no basis for respondents' meaning. As the legislative history in 1969 and this court's holdings in cases like Shields illustrates, the purpose behind the legislative or the deficiency scheme is to accord fairness to both parties. Fairness is accorded to the debtor, fairness is accorded to the creditor by ensuring that it can fully recover on its debt. Fairness is accorded to the debtor by ensuring that the creditor does not over-recover on its debt. In this case, there's no suggestion that BB&T would over-recover. After all, its deficiency against respondents would still be guided by the fair market offset in 4459. On the other hand, what respondents ask for is a windfall. They ask that BB&T not be able to fully recover because it can't recover deficiency. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bogart.
Madam Chief Justice, members of the Judiciary and the State Council, my name is Scott Bogatz, and I'm proud to be here today on behalf of the respondents in this appeal. My argument today will start and end at the same place, and that is a request, a plea, that this court impose the words of the statute and the words of the loan agreement and uphold the district court's decision where the district court went by the words of the statute and the words of the loan agreement. So we start, of course, with the statute, where we should start. Upon the application, this is NRS 40.455, subsection 1, upon the application of the judgment creditor or the beneficiary of the deed of trust, within 6 months after the date of the foreclosure sale, or the trustee's sale held pursuant to NRS 107.080. It's very specific language. It says what it says, and a bank or anybody who's holding a note has to follow that language to go through a different deficiency process. In the same way that they have to file an application within 6 months. They can't come and say, well, we kind of followed that rule, and we sort of followed the six-month rule, but not quite. It's specific language, and it was intended to be specific language.
So your position is that NRS 107.080 applies extraterritorially?
Actually, just the opposite, I think, Your Honor, and I thought about this a lot. In preparation for today's argument, I went back and reread the brief that my partner, Mr. Vlasic, and Mr. Lee wrote about how to interpret the statutes and what the court had meant through Shields and its progeny about anti-deficiency, and I thought, they're right. And then I read this from the Forge brief and my former partner, Mr. Rock's brief, about KeyBank and the words that say narrowly construed language, and then I read KeyBank, and I thought, they're right too. And I couldn't figure out for a little while how those two combined until I read and reread KeyBank. It's a little hard to read because the way that the court came to that statute was in the reverse, so it has three or four negatives in the sentence. But Mr. LaForge was right about the facts. A party came to the lower court and in this court and said, there's an Arizona statute.
Alaska statute.
Yeah, Alaska. Correct. I'm sorry about that.
I'm familiar with that case.
That's right. There's an Alaska statute, 34.20.100, that I want to take advantage of. And that Alaska statute says, if a trustee sale is done under the Alaska statute, there is no deficiency. And the party, now in that case, the party wasn't bank, the party was the borrower and the guarantors, but the party came to this court and said, I know it says under that statute, but squint your eyes at it. They probably didn't mean just the Alaska statute. If you squint at it, they probably meant everybody's power of sale statute. And this one, you know, it happened to be in Nevada, so they used Nevada power of sale statute. So don't you really think that's what they meant? And this court said, no. More than they know, they can show. It says you can avail yourself of that statute if the sale is done under the Alaska statute, period. And we're not going to impose it extraterritorially. We're not going to read beyond that. We're going to hold them to the letters of the letters of the statute. And sorry, pardon, in that case, the borrower, you can't avail yourself. We're in the exact opposite position now. The bank is coming and saying, we want to use the anti-deficiency statute. And I know, Your Honors, that it says pursuant to the Nevada power of sale, but they don't really mean that. Squint your eyes at it, and they probably meant everybody's power of sale statute. We're just asking you to do the same exact thing you did in KeyBank, just in reverse. And it took me a little while to get there, because I had to read that KeyBank opinion several times to get there, but it's the same exact thing. So the Nevada legislature said you can use our power of sale statute in Nevada or anybody's courts. You can really trust everybody's courts. If you go to a judicial sale anywhere, that's fine because we trust that process. If you use our procedure, that's fine because we trust our procedure. But you can't go beyond that, and you can't read beyond that. The first thing that I want to say about the issue of Forge's well-made argument.
Let me pause you there for a moment. The statute 40.4551 says it's within 6 months after the date of the foreclosure sale or the trustee's sale held pursuant to 107080, comma, respectively, comma. To me, it's as plausible to read the statute as the pursuant to NRS 107080 modifying trustee sale and have foreclosure sale be a larger universe. Certainly, it seems reasonable to say the statute's ambiguous. Would you agree with that?
I don't agree it's ambiguous, but let's look at it as if it were ambiguous to go down that path.
Yes.
It's a fair point, so we went back and looked at it, and of course, as this court has said several times, many times, Davis in 2012 and before that, you have to read every word of the statute. So let's read it that way. Let's say it says, on the application, 6 months after the foreclosure sale, and let's interpret foreclosure sale to mean any kind of a sale, whether a judicial foreclosure or a power of sale foreclosure in Texas or Alaska or anywhere else.
Or as defined in 40.462 subsection 4.
Then there's no reason. Then there's no reason to include the next five or six words. If we read foreclosure sale to mean any type of foreclosure sale, either our trust, our power of sale, or our judicial process, or anybody else's power of sale, or their judicial process, there would be no reason to say, or the trustee's sale held pursuant to NRS 107.080, in the same way that this court said it in KeyBank. I mean, that was the argument you made in KeyBank, is don't look at it that way. They just meant that as an example, and you got to read it more broadly than that. This court said, no, if they had meant it more broadly, they would have said it. They wouldn't have included that language if the legislature didn't mean it, because, of course, we can't go back and understand what was in each person's mind and why decisions were made. We can only look at the statute and see what was actually said. And to read it that way, it excludes the next five words. And this court has said many times, you simply can't do that when you're interpreting a statute. I don't really think we need to get there. I think it's clear on its face. But even if there's an ambiguity there, I think Davis and the cases that come before it say read all the words, and if you read all the words, there's really no other way to read it. And what's interesting is, BB&T tells you many times not to read it our way, but they never tell you how you should read it. They never tell you why that language was included if it wasn't included for the fairly obvious reason. So they don't even give you kind of an alternative interpretation. I thought I'd be faced with this question, of course. I was trying to think of an analogy, and I came up with one that is, it's a terrible analogy. It's really imperfect, but I think it sets the tone. Years ago, other states did not enforce gaming debts. And so they said, I know Nevada has this thing, and you can go to Nevada and do it. And by the way, if you go to an Nevada court and you get a judgment, we trust that, fair faith and credit. But you can't come to us under our statutes. Very important analogy. Looking at Justice Stricker, and I thought five things wrong with it. She just thought another five things wrong with it. So, but the flavor is the same. I mean, the flavor being, we trust our process, and we trust everybody's courts. And this is the poster child for it. There are states, and I think there was a question earlier, there are states where our procedures are similar. Texas is not one of them. Texas has a three-week process. Nevada has close to a four-month process. Very detailed, very defined, not accidental. So we're not even comparing apples to apples. If it were Arizona, it would be closer. They have a closer process to us. The bottom line here is that the bank, for some reason, when they drafted these, chose their poison. They said, we want to be in Texas for the one end, but we choose Nevada. I don't know why they did. Maybe if it were Utah, it's because there's a shorter statute even in Utah. So they picked it. And then they picked the process.
So the land is in Texas, right?
That's right. But they could have said, you know, obviously there's been contacts, other projects in Texas. They could have said, everything would be in Texas. Texas law, Texas land, and then we wouldn't have this issue here. They didn't want to. They wanted Texas law for the foreclosure and Nevada law for the deficiency action. That's the first choice they made. And then they chose to go through a power of sale in Texas in 3 weeks rather than judicial foreclosure. They didn't need to be here. They chose the process both times, and they now come to this court and say, squish your eyes and help us out of this. And I've got to say, I really struggle with whether to bring this point up, but they've said it in their briefs a number of times, and then Mr. LaForge ended with it, with the plea that there would be a windfall. Now, I know there are other cases facing this court, but the principal of BB&T standing before this court saying, poor us, it's a windfall to these people who are wiped out. It's just beyond the pale. This is one occasion where the bank chose the word in documents, the bank chose the procedure to follow, and they should be held to it. They had the choice all along. They chose it, and they should be held with it. I'm going to
sit down. Sit down. I've got one other question.
Yes, sir, because I want to get to the important topic of attorney's fees. I want to get to the important topic of attorney's fees.
I just have one question before you sit down. Under 10708R, are there protections built in there that are Nevada-specific that are policy issues that we need to consider?
Oh.
Is that why perhaps they refer to the foreclosure sale being conducted pursuant to that particular statute?
Very clearly. Here, not just a little bit, a lot.
Policy considerations from your standpoint.
You know, it was 1969, kind of the last time Nevada went through the upheavals it's recently went through. And at that point, banks were overreaching. They were trying to get the recoveries, and there were problems. So the legislature came together and very expressly said, we're trying to build some protections here, and they're specific. 45 days to bring the loan current. Then another, I think, 75 days, and then it gets to 120 that you can pay off the loan. It's got to be published three times. Very specific rules.
There's Nevada-specific protections that Texas didn't have.
That Texas specifically didn't have. They went a different route.
Mr. Bilbrecht, are you finished?
Yes.
Yes, let me just tell you, though, that you're in your co-counsel's time.
And I'll answer, of course, any questions.
But of course, you have
1 million on attorney's fees.
Could the bank have foreclosed on the Texas property under 107?
They could not have, Your Honor. They would have had to do a judicial foreclosure in Texas.
So if the court interprets 40.455 in the manner in which you suggest, have we not therefore precluded any borrowing on property that is and secured by property outside of Nevada?
I don't think so at all, Your Honor. I think just the opposite. The bank could have the Texas law apply and they wouldn't have this problem. They could have done a judicial foreclosure in Texas. They had lots of options. They will continue to loan as they do in every state that has limitations on deficiency actions. This is not a freezing. This is simply saying to the bank, You only have a few rules you have to follow, but at least follow those. And I don't think it will have any effect beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Lastly, let me just
say... Every state does this, though. There's no other... This is an aberration.
Well, other states have it even stronger, and KeyBank is a perfect example. In KeyBank, you can't get a deficiency at all if you use their power of sale provision. So various states, and I know this has been in other cases, have different levels of protection, some higher than Nevada, many lower than Nevada, and we fit somewhere in that continuum. Lastly, let me just point out, on the attorney's fees, the loan agreement, the first page of the loan agreement, which is in the appendix at 345, says this loan and incorporates the note, the guarantee, and everything else, and then says if there's a fight, the prevailing party gets attorney's fees. But then we come back and say, well, the fight wasn't exactly under that document. They also argue that the guarantee and the note preclude attorney's fees. They do not. They have the normal language, if we have to sue you, we get attorney's fees. They do not say you do not get attorney's fees. What we said in the loan agreement isn't true. They just have that normal language. Again, many states, a unilateral clause is enough. Here, you have to have a bilateral clause, but at least when you have the bilateral clause, it should be enforced and the attorney's fees should be awarded. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Could you reset the clock at 3 minutes for him and add 3 minutes to appellants or 2 minutes to appellants?
Thank you, Justices. John Mansour appearing on behalf of Tom Acevedo. He was an employee that got a small fraction of the interest in the borrower on a $17 million loan. The other co-borrowers are all in bankruptcy, so basically KeyBank is bringing this action against an unemployed leasing agent. We've cited the facts. They've acquired the loan for 30 cents on the dollar. They have mounted a brief that probably cost more than my client made in the last 2 years.
Mr. Mansour, on the legal issues, though, what's your interpretation of NRS 455 subsection 1?
Sure. It's actually unambiguous. You look at the text of the language. Actually, the comments with respectively clear up the language. If there was any question under the, now that we're into commas, the last antecedent principle, when you look at the types of confusions that are created by commas, frequently there's a list of things with no comma, and the question is, what does that refer to? In this case, the language is clear, and the reasons are clear. Nevada's history of the anti-deficiency law supports that. Up until the McMillan decision in 1967, there was no deficiency after a trustee's sale. If you look at the legislative history, you'll see one of the comments was that it's the only state in the country that allows the deficiency action after a trustee's sale. Keep in mind that NRS 40.453, the statute that makes it against the public policy of the state for any document to deny a borrower and now guarantors the benefits of the statutes, was enacted as part of this statute to further protect the borrowers. Additionally, there was a separate section, section 494, which would have eliminated deficiencies in their entirety. So, with regard to NRS 40.451, deficiency actions or any action following a trustee sale was unknown until the 1967 McMillan decision. The legislature came in. The purpose was to restrict deficiencies and to introduce the fair value rule because of abuses that appeared in the Hidden Wells case in 1968, where there had been a non-judicial foreclosure sale, and the price of the property was determined to be what the set-off was that the borrower was entitled to. The legislature came back. The legislative history says, we've seen the same statute over and over again. And to address one of the other issues raised, which is the seminal mantra of the banks, this is going to destroy all lending in Nevada. They were talking about the same thing in 1969. They talk about it every time the issues come up. The reality is the bank has several immunities. They have, like we do, when we foreclose in California, we judicially foreclose, or in Alaska, or in Washington. you judicially foreclose to protect your deficiency. Or you can sue another state and enforce your judgment under the full faith and credit law. These lenders have every entitlement and every protection. And now they come back and they're saying, now we want to try and torture a reading of this plain and unambiguous language to try and create a right for lenders which is not cognizable. The Nevada legislature, given the history of our cases, severely restrictive deficiencies, it says, fine lenders, if you want, you're more than entitled to come to our state and get a deficiency, provided that you judicially foreclose. Or, if you get a judgment in another state where this may contravene some of our policies, you'll still get full enforcement under the full faith and credit law when you come to enforce that in Nevada. However, if you want to do a deficiency action after a trustee sale, the entire mechanism is not designed to promote deficiencies after another sale in a foreign jurisdiction. How is it, we have to come, originally in 3 months, now 6 months. The court appoints an appraiser. The appraiser can come in, and the court can independently appraise. The entire system, the entire purpose, the legislative history, all support that which is patently obvious by the language of the statute. If you want to take advantage of a deficiency after a non-judicial foreclosure sale, and you foreclose in another state, you do so at your own peril, it is a garden variety risk that lenders face every day in determining in advance what they want to do. Under the facts of this case, this is certainly a case where the borrower is being abused, where the very purposes of both the one action rule and the anti-deficiency statute are not being met, and factually it's a horrible case for the bank. They backdated their notice. Excuse me.
Thank you very much. Chief, before this is done, can I have just briefly comment on 4430.22?
Should it come forward?
Which doesn't, seems not to limit the ability to seek judicial foreclosures as the trustees.
And under the one action rule,
4430. As a whole, it goes into.
Well, first of all, 40.430 is the one action rule, and it deals with whether you can, it didn't attempt to, 40.430 did not attempt to impact any of this court's precedent. It merely listed those cases and those exceptions. So if I were to take some action in another jurisdiction, if I were to foreclose in another jurisdiction, would that result in a forfeiture of my security here in Nevada?
Well, no, because you'd have to have some security in Nevada that would impact.
So in this case, the one action rule isn't implicated in any way, shape, or form, nor would it be under that exception. If I do some action in another jurisdiction and I still have a security of which I might forfeit, then when I come back to Nevada and say, hey, listen, I judicially foreclosed in Utah, or I non-judicially foreclosed in Maine, but I still have security in Nevada, have I waived my security interest under NRS 40.430. That is what that is designed to deal with. And I think there was a Colorado case where somebody had taken an enforcement action and actually forfeited a security interest in Nevada, I don't have it off the top of my head, but I'm generally familiar with it. But the court held that, no, you got a judgment against so-and-so in Colorado, you came back to Nevada, you're trying to enforce your security interest, and it's been forfeited under the one action rule. We're here under the fair value rule. What are your rights after the sale? When you're simply going to enforce, and the court says the note, although I think it's more or less a hybrid of the fair market value comes back in as your offset, but you're coming in to enforce the note after the fact. We're not interested or concerned with whether there's been a forfeiture of security in Nevada because that issue isn't even implicated. The arguments are red herring.
Thank you. Does anyone else have any questions? Respondents.
There are many points I'd like to respond to, but I'm going to choose two. On the other points, I'll rest on our briefs, which I think have addressed many of the issues raised by respondents. First, response, as a matter of equity, seems to suggest that it's just to withhold the efficiency from BBT. Because because it's a bank, and because it chose to use Texas's trustee sale procedure. I'd like to respond by noting that BB&T didn't decide to develop and collateralize property in Texas, where Texas's real property law must govern. That was respondents. While Mr. Bogatz mentioned several times that BB&T had these provisions in the deed of trust, respondents agreed with those provisions. They agreed in the deed of trust that Texas's trustee sale procedure would govern. They even agreed that the notice period would govern in this case.
But you also agreed that Nevada would govern actions on the loan agreement of the note, correct?
Right, because the two are separated. Because the property is in Texas, Texas's in-rim jurisdiction must control any action, whereas recovery against the debtors personally must occur in Nevada because they're in Nevada notes. Most importantly, in terms of fairness, respondents have never suggested that the notice period in this case, or the distinctions between Texas's trustee sale procedure and Nevada's, made any difference in this case. They've never suggested that they could have redeemed the property. And in fact, while Texas has a three-week notice period, respondents actually had 8 months. Their default occurred in July 2009. The trustee sale occurred in March 2010. Therefore, the arguments have nothing to do with fairness. They are purely technical arguments based on a statute that's been in the books for 44 years and has not been construed in this manner. The second point I want to respond to is the issue of text. And both sets of counsel implore this court to look closely at the text and construe it as written. I agree. But where their analysis starts and ends with seven words in the middle of a clause that sets forth a statute of limitations, we've tried to take a deeper look at that text and the circumstances that surround it. In this regard, BB&T's interpretation is consistent with the exceptions to the one action rule. It's consistent with the manner in which this legislature has drafted that pursuant to language in other deficiency statutes, such as 4464 and 4463. It's consistent with this bank's two holdings in Key Bank of Alaska. It's consistent with the legislative history for 4455 in 1969. And it's consistent with fairness. The court has no further questions.
Mr. Bogatz challenged you to offer us your textual reading of this statute, 40.4551, and I would be interested to hear that.
Okay, and I was a little nervous, so I'm not sure if I ever got to it. But you'll find it in our text, and I'll tell you what it is right now. It's that that reference to 17080 should be read to serve an illustrative function. The legislature is merely trying to explain what it means by the term trustee sale within the context. Again, when subsection 1 was enacted in 1969, it contained Chapter 40's first reference to the term trustee sale, whereas judicial foreclosure was already outlined in 4430. Moreover, this reading is consistent with the manner in which the legislature has drafted other deficiency statutes, like I said, 4463 and 4464. Any other questions?
Does anyone have any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to thank both sides and amicus. The briefs were really excellent and the oral arguments were very helpful to the court. We'll stand in recess in the case of being submitted.